And a very good morning to you. Are you well? Are you in fine fettle? It's a windy one in South Manchester this Sunday. Very windy. Very windy. Looking at the trees out the studio window. How you doing? It's the 27th of January 2019. And of course, my name is Richie Allen. This is Sunday View, looking at the front pages of the UK's newspapers, listening in to the mid-morning political talk shows as well. Thanks for joining me then. Let's do it.
Asking the questions mainstream journalists will never ask. This is your Richie Allen Show on richieallen.co.uk, Fab Radio 2 in Manchester, and triggerwarning.tv.
And as usual, the way to reach me is through Twitter. It's at Richie Allen Show on Twitter. That's where you can send me a tweet during the programme. Thanks for getting up for Sunday View. Good to be with you.
It's the Richie Allen Show, broadcasting live on richieallen.co.uk and multiple platforms around the world. And now, here's your host, Richie Allen.
So there is a bit of Brexit stuff in the papers, as you'd expect, but I have promised through the avenue of social media not to dwell too much on Brexit today. There's also some very interesting sociological stories in the papers today. Lots of interesting stuff. We'll get through a lot, I think, in the next hour. And as I've already said, no need for me to labour the point. I look forward to reading your tweets this Sunday. Alrighty. Yeah, I'm having a nice weekend. Relaxing weekend. Stayed up very late last night, way past my bedtime. The future Mrs. Allen, Jazz and myself were dancing around in the living room at 1 o'clock this morning to a selection of choice 70s disco cuts when we looked at the time and went, be Jesus, we don't stay up this late, and went to bed. So I'm a bit peaked this morning, but I'm in great form. It's good to be alive. I think it is. It's good to be alive. Despite what's... despite the madness of the world we inhabit and the madness of some of the things we're going to talk about today. Lots of you saying good morning to me on Twitter. Very kind of you. Good morning. Good morning, Gail. Good morning, Delroy. Good morning, Patrick. And good morning, Jackie. And good morning, she of the Cruach as well. Love the Twitter handles. Shall we look at the front pages then, straight off? Let's get into it. The Sunday Times, Murdoch's Times, leads with this. This is important. We're not going to open with Brexit today. This is an important story, and it has been picked up by everybody. The Sunday Times front page reads, revealed how big tech pushes teens to suicide. Serious story, this. This is a story in the Times about a group of families who have come together to accuse technology companies of abetting their children's suicide by hosting self-harm images and other disturbing content. This all comes as the health secretary told social media sites to take responsibility for their effect on young lives, right? Okay. Now, Sky News reporter Sadia Chowdhury has followed this over the weekend, and you'll hear her now speaking on Sky News Breakfast this morning. This is Sadia Chowdhury, the Times headline, How Big Tech Pushes Teens to Suicide. Sadia Chowdhury.
So Molly was 14 when she took her own life in November 2017. And Molly's father says that the more he looked into her online accounts following her death, the more he got a glimpse into the negative and profound effects that they had on his daughter's life. And he's not the only one. 30 families have come together now accusing social media companies of abetting their children's suicides. Accusing them of promoting online images that glorify self-harm and suicide and things like that. And off the back of this, the Health Secretary, Matt Hancock, has written a letter to the tech firms. He's calling for urgent action. And in his letter, he says, "It is appalling how easy it still is to access this content online. And I am in no doubt about the harm the material can cause, especially for young people. It is time for internet and social media providers to step up and purge this content once and for all. And of course, Instagram denies promoting any images that glorify self-harm or suicide. Instead, it says that it helps in recovery by connecting users to each other so that they can discuss the similar issues that they face. And the health secretary isn't the only one talking about this. The Duke of Cambridge, Prince William, last year accused tech firms of failing to protect children adequately. He said they're beyond their depths when it comes to tackling the negative effects that their platforms have.
Now, first off, I've got to say, some very good friends of mine many years ago in Waterford had to deal with their son, who was 13 at the time, had, in a cry for help, had attempted to commit suicide. Not certain that he really meant to go through with it, but it went wrong and he asphyxiated himself and he died. I'll never forget the devastation to the family. I can't imagine anything worse for a family, you know, dealing with the horrors of suicide, whether it's a youngster or whether it's somebody older and more mature. It's just horrifying that somebody could do something like that. And I imagine the guilt and the self-loathing that families are left with for years afterwards because of, the, you know, being haunted by, could I have done something? And I've seen this up close. And I wouldn't argue with the families, the 30 families who've come together to go after social media companies. I wouldn't be heartless enough to argue with them. But I'm worried about this. And I think you should be worried about it as well. How could a social media company host images of self-harm or disturbing content, images that it could be proven were a serious factor in the decision that a teenager then made to either self-harm or to take their own life? I don't understand it. Of course, you might say, well, you're not a psychiatrist, Richie, you're not a psychologist. I'm also not stupid. I'm not saying for a minute that the images that we're exposed to and the films that we're exposed to don't have an effect on us, on our psyche. And I'm all too aware of the ability to subliminally program people using images. I have no doubt that all that's going on. But the idea that the government of this country could say to social media companies, we want to be in a position where we can tell you at any time of day or night that you must remove this content, A, B or C, because we say that it could have a potentially harmful effect on somebody. That's very sinister. Are we really saying that images alone or messages or text read by a teenager can on its own drive a child to suicide? It reminds me of the video Nasty Days. I was thinking of my friend and colleague Hayden Hewitt this morning, who's an expert on this, back in the day when films were banned and things were censored because it was said that they could have an effect on people. I know some people listening to this might say, there's an element of hypocrisy, Richie, because you've had people on the programme before talking about mind control and how easy it is to access the deepest, you know, subconscious regions of people's minds and then to influence them. Yeah, I'm not denying any of that. I just find this weird, you know. There's also an element of this where it's the state taking responsibility for parenting again. It's the nanny state as well, you know, censorship. And maybe using the horrible situations that these parents find themselves in, using their story to kind of usher in a kind of a creeping censorship, you know, basically censoring anything. Anything the state doesn't like being declared harmful or promoting self-harm or suicide or promoting hate or whatever. It then becomes very easy for things to be deleted and to be taken down based on a very extreme case. I don't imagine too many children around the world have tried to kill themselves or have committed self-harm because they saw an image on Facebook or on Instagram. I can't imagine the numbers are very big, to be honest. Anyway, right, that's the Sunday Times today. That might be something to chat about going forward. The Sunday Express, Brexit deal, EU will blink first. That is the headline. Brexit deal, EU will blink first. Written, the story is written by David Maddox. It's short on detail, really. The Sunday Express is saying that if the UK government holds firm to its red lines and won't tolerate any backstop nonsense, well, the Sunday Express is saying that the EU will blink first, because the EU, according to the Express, and I think the Express is right, the European Union is very, very nervous about the UK leaving with no deal. Now, I do believe that. Of course, the European Union is terrified of the UK leaving with no deal, because the European Union knows that it will not be able to impose punitive measures on the UK. You see, the EU knows this. It knows that it cannot impose punitive tariffs and measures on the UK because there's a trade deficit between the UK and the EU. The EU countries collectively, the UK market is more important to the UK than the EU market is to the UK. Yeah, I've said that right, haven't I? Basically, they sell more to us than we sell to them. Not for a minute saying that the 37% or whatever it is of UK exports that goes to Europe isn't important. It is, of course. But they sell more. And I said this a million times. Can you imagine the heads of Audi and Volkswagen and BMW and the heads of the Vineyards and the heads of every other company in Europe that sells into the UK? They wouldn't tolerate any tariffs. So yes, I agree with the Sunday Express that basically May should tell them to go and do a run and jump. The Sunday Observer, UK firms plan, UK firms plan mass exodus if May allows no deal Brexit. So this is more of the old Project Fear. This is a warning from British Chambers of Commerce that thousands of UK companies have already put in place emergency plans to cope with a no deal Brexit, many of them planning even to move abroad in such a situation. Now, the Sunday Observer is, to be fair to it, unapologetic. It is a paper of Remain. It has an editorial policy of supporting Remain, so therefore it is very happy to publish these stories all the time about how people are going to be jobless, potless, toothless, God knows what else, if we leave with no deal, right? That's the Observer. What is it, 12 minutes past 11, it is 12 minutes past the hour, depending on where you are, 12 minutes past 11 here in the UK, as I speak to you now. So, the Sunday Telegraph, Tory fury as election watchdog seeks police powers. What does that mean? Tory fury as election watchdog seeks police powers. Well, the election watchdog, which is a real body, by the way, it's supposedly a bipartisan body. It's a regulatory body that oversees spending and conduct in elections, whether it be local elections or national elections or referenda. So the election watchdog is seeking police powers. What does that mean? Well, the election watchdog wants the power to prosecute political parties and referendum campaigns in the future by itself without using the police. This is very interesting, right? So rather than pass any information it has on to the police, the election watchdog wants the power for itself to prosecute political parties and referendum campaigns if the election watchdog believes they have breached any rules. Now, pro-Brexit groups are absolutely apoplectic about this. They're spitting feathers because they point to a number of examples that demonstrates that the election watchdog has been biased and has shown bias to the Remain campaign. What does that mean? Well, it means that if there's a second referendum, and you bet your goddamn bottom dollar, there will be a second referendum. We're not going anywhere. We know this. In the second referendum, the Brexiteers fear that if these powers are given to the watchdog, they would be used to hammer the Leave side in the next EU referendum. You with me? So that's a big story in the Sunday Telegraph today. And as you know, there's a big week coming up, dear listener. A big week because Theresa May will go back to Parliament on Tuesday for another vote. Desperate to try and get this this agreement, this remain, this, excuse me, the withdrawal agreement that she made with the European Union, the withdrawal agreement that a couple of weeks ago was hammered in the biggest defeat ever for a prime minister, well, at least in 90 years anyway. She's coming back with a few tweaks here and there on Tuesday. It's not expected to succeed on Tuesday, right? So Tuesday's a big day. But before they vote on Theresa May's deal on Tuesday, there will be votes on a number of amendments to her deal. Now, you've heard a lot about the amendments. These are amendments by Yvette Cooper and Dominic Grieve and other Remainers. Admittedly, there are one or two amendments by Brexiteers, but the main amendments that will be discussed and debated to Theresa May's deal, these amendments have been put forward by people like Yvette Cooper and Dominic Grieve. They are Remainers. Do you understand any of these amendments? What's going on? Let's let Grace Blakely sort it out for us. She's a financial journalist, is Grace, and she explains the amendments to Andrew Marr on BBC One this morning, The Marr Show. Grace Blakely with the amendments explained.
So first you've got the Cooper Amendment, which essentially aims to push back that Article 50 deadline for another 3 months in the
postponus leaving for up to 9 months.
Exactly, aiming to basically avoid a no-deal Brexit, which most MPs are kind of against. Then you've got a couple which aim to explicitly hand power over to Parliament in order to kind of see what holds sway.
Is this the so-called indicative votes where Parliament says we could vote for customs union, we could vote for this, and you go through all the options and see what Parliament might actually want?
Yeah, so that's in what Hilary Benn has proposed. You've also got the Grieve amendments, which hands parliamentary time to exploring various different options. And, you know, it makes sense that in the context of the executive being unable to pass this legislation, that the initiative passes to Parliament.
But we've also got a couple of amendments possible, which are very helpful to the government in the sense they say, let's get rid of the backstop from the withdrawal agreement, get rid of it and find alternative arrangements for the customs union. If that passed, that would send Theresa May back to Brussels with a stronger negotiating hand.
It absolutely would. And this is the point of the Brady Amendment, is that they're, you know, these MPs are basically saying the only reason that the withdrawal agreement didn't pass was because of this issue around the backstop and potentially keeping the UK in a permanent customs union. So if they were able to deal with that, that would be a big coup for May. But it's not clear how they would resolve that issue of the border over the long term.
Yeah, and the border is a non-issue. The backstop should be explained every time I talk about it, because I know that listeners, not because of any lack of intelligence, but because they just zone out when they hear discussion of it on the telly or on the radio. The backstop is an insurance policy dreamt up by the European Union. It's a spanner in the works. The European Union said that because of the Good Friday Agreement and because things are better on the Ireland of, on the island even of Ireland, politically, in terms of people are not bombing each other and killing one another anymore, right? Republicans and loyalists, it's all, it's been a better 21 years or whatever since the Good Friday Agreement. We can't have a hard border on Ireland. We can't have a hard border on Ireland. The European Union dreamt all this up. So the backstop would mean that if the UK left the European Union with no deal, the UK would remain in a temporary customs union with the EU in order to avoid a hard border. The hard border is a big red herring. It's a load of old bollocks. So it is. There's no need for it. If the Republic of Ireland, if Ireland, let's say Ireland, it's Ireland, my country, if Ireland wasn't such a pathetic lapdog and totally owned by the European Union, the Irish government would say, feck off, there's going to be no hard border. We'll carry on as normal. To hell with the European Union. But of course, because the Irish government cannot make any such decision on its own, because there's no democracy in Ireland, there's no sovereignty, this whole backstop nonsense was basically put in as a big spanner in the works, to keep the UK in the European Union come hell or high water. Yvette Cooper and her amendments. So these amendments that have been attached to Theresa May's vote, to her deal, which will be voted on Tuesday, are designed to keep us in the European Union one way or another, to delay Article 50, to keep us in for as long as possible until we can get this second referendum. Now, Yvette Cooper was on the Andrew Marr Show today, but I won't subject you to her as you're probably eating your breakfast. and Yvette Cooper is nauseating. Cooper's pal, Angela Rayner, the Shadow Education Secretary, she's a Labour MP. She was on Sky News with Sophie Ridge. We're coming to the end of the Brexit report this morning. Told you I'd keep it brief. Angela Rayner, Shadow Education Secretary, was on with Sophie Ridge, and Sophie Ridge had a good question for her about democracy.
Now, the frontbench's own amendment puts the option of a second referendum on a table. But recently, your party chairman, Ian Lavery, has said that asking the voters to vote again on an issue they've already given an answer on until they come up with the right answer risks serious damage to the relationship between many citizens and politicians at Westminster. So I'm interested in your own view on this. What do you think having a second referendum or Labour backing a second referendum would do to democracy?
Now, before Rayner answers that, you must know that Rayner is pushing very, very, very hard to take no deal out of Theresa May's hands, which is just ridiculous, really. Why would you tie the hands of a negotiator and say you can't threaten the EU with no deal? Rayner is one of those, so don't think that she's any champion of democracy. However, her answer is interesting.
Well, our conference motion was very clear and we said we wouldn't rule that out. But let me be clear. I think that if we end up in a second referendum, then us as politicians have failed the public. We failed to be able to do our job. I will see that as a really difficult situation for us all to be in. I don't think people want to see a delay in Article 50. I don't think people want to see us in a second referendum. They want to see parliamentarians working together to carry out what happened in the result of the referendum, to get the best possible deal we can for Britain moving forward. And the only way we can do that next week is by Theresa May actually genuinely working across Parliament and looking at her red lines and seeing how she can build that consensus. I still think that can happen, but Theresa May has to be willing to put her own views aside and to work with Parliament. And for the last 2.5 years, unfortunately, she's not been willing to do that. I hope she does now, next week.
How would you vote if there was another referendum? And do you think that Leave would just win again?
I would be really worried about a second referendum, to be honest. I don't think that people necessarily will expect the result that they get. I think, if anything, it'll be very narrow. And worst case scenario is it'll be a very narrow Remain. And then what, we're going to have the best of three?
Yeah, let's have the best of three and then the best of five. Let's have referenda forevermore. Angela Rayner there. It's not happening, is it? No Brexit. Right, the last front page. What have we not done? I don't think we've done the Mail on Sunday. We've done the Observer. We've done the Telegraph, the Sunday Times, the Express. Yeah, so the Mail on Sunday, front page headline, not that interesting to us, but obviously for the family it is. Witness who nails speedboat killer's cruel lies. This is about Jack Shepherd. It's been in the news all week long, who escaped to Georgia during his trial for capsizing his speedboat. Isn't that right? He was on the Thames and his girlfriend was in the was in a boat with him. He was driving, but he claimed that she was driving. The speedboat capsized and she drowned. And he was on trial and then he fled. He's been found in Georgia, I believe. In his absence, he was found guilty of manslaughter. There's a prison sentence for that. And they're trying to get him out of Georgia now and back to the UK. Apparently, his claims that his girlfriend at the time, Charlotte Brown, was driving have been thrown into doubt, that he's telling porky pies. That's the Mail on Sunday. When we come back from a brief musical interlude, I will read some of your tweets, I promise, and then we'll have a look at one or two more stories inside the newspapers today. It is your Sunday View. It is the 27th of January 2019. I am Richie Allen, and I mean it when I say it's lovely to be with you. Let's have some Charles Aznavour to brighten up this pretty grim, windy morning in South Manchester. Let's have some Charles Aznavour. This is delightful.
Nous avions tous deux un rendez-vous amoureux mercredi à 8h dans ma demeure.
Oui.
Ouh.
Yes! Charles Aznavour and Sur La Table on the Richie Allen Show. What a tune that is. 26 minutes past 11 this Sunday. Loads of tweets this morning. Good morning. Good morning, Mwinga. I swear, Richie, every week Andrew Marr brings up the backstop deal. I doubt the majority of us know what it is. Brexit. Hashtag Brexit, says Moinga, Dean Smith says it's my Ireland, channeling his brave heart there. Good morning, Dean. Kim tweets, I suppose week in, week out, I'm seeing the collapse of Britain with this Brexit betrayal. As Gerald Celente sagely says, when people feel they have lost everything and have nothing left to lose, they lose it. Blood will eventually fill the streets, says Kim. Kim, hold on to that thought, because there is a story about that in the press, which I'll get to in a minute. Thanks for that comment. In This Together says to Angela Rayner, no, Rayner, the only way we can get a good deal is by convincing the European Union that we will leave with no deal. David Stanford tweets, it might not seem like it, but the world is looking into this debacle, realising that democracy is just a fallacy. If it's pushed, it will prove dangerous to the controllers. Again, thanks for that. Thanks for all your comments. There is a story in the press this morning about civil unrest, which I will get to in a minute, and then we really will this time leave Brexit behind us. Good morning to Les Hewitt. Charles Aznavour has no voice, says Les Hewitt. Charles Aznavour, legend. Right, shall we do that story briefly then? It's in the Sunday Times. It's in the Sunday Times, page 2 or page 3. It's UK ready to declare martial law to avert no deal Brexit chaos. Martial law. The government is gaming the use of drastic powers to halt unrest if the UK crashes out of the European Union. According to the Sunday Times, Whitehall officials, have been gaming a state of emergency and even the introduction of martial law in the event of disorder, as they're looking at how to use the sweeping powers available under the Civil Contingencies Act 2004 to stop any civil disobedience resulting from the nation leaving the European Union on March 29th. This came in, this act, in 2004. Yes, Richie, get it right. Under Tony Blair, the mass murdering scumbag Blair brought this in. At the time it came in 2004, it was in response to a previous foot and mouth disease outbreak. You remember that? And they brought it in. They kind of sneaked it in. They snuck it in, saying it was all about foot and mouth. Load of bollocks. It was about people eventually taking to the streets. What sort of powers? Well, curfews, bans on travel, confiscation of property, and the deployment of the armed forces to quell rioting are among the measures available to ministers under the legislation. Imagine it. That's what they're saying in the Times. Doesn't make it true, of course. Powers that can be used under the legislation, which civil libertarians, people who fight for civil liberties, they've called it truly draconian. Listen to this. This is the text of the document. Any provision which the person making the regulations is satisfied is appropriate. So any provision which the person making the regulations is satisfied is appropriate. So basically, the law of 2004 says that the government can do whatever the hell it likes, as long as it's satisfied that it is appropriate. Appropriate to do what? Well, appropriate to protect human life, health and safety, and to protect or to restore property and supplies of money, food, water, energy or fuel. It's great that you have this bullshit, because it does bring to people's attention these laws that were passed back 14, 15 years ago that they might not have been aware of. You see, we've got our own Patriot Act here, by the way. It's just most people don't know it. It's 11:30. There you are. Right. Children as young as 11 are being taken into care over fears they are addicted to gaming, with 13 youngsters removed from their families in 2 months due to concerns over computer use. Now, I know you don't believe that. I know you're thinking it can't be true. People who engage with me on Twitter will note that last night, while I was dancing around half pissed with the future Mrs. Allen having a wee Bacardi, I did tweet this out, this story. Children as young as 11 taken into care over fears they are addicted to gaming. 13 youngsters removed from their families in 2 months due to concerns over computer usage. Experts are warning parents to watch out for signs of addiction in their children. Because if you don't watch out for signs of addiction in your child, you're a bad parent and we will take your child away from you. there's gold in them their children, so there is. It's £1 billion a year industry. Stealing children and putting them with foster parents makes some people a lot of money. Lot of dosh. So they're looking for new, weird and fantastic and visionary ways of stealing your children. Data shows, this is the Sunday Mail, the Mail on Sunday to be fair to it, and the Daily Mail is one of the only newspapers in the country, and the Telegraph some years ago with Christopher Booker, that has the balls to talk about forced adoption or stealing children. State-sanctioned child kidnapping is what it is. Data shows the children from Yorkshire, Merseyside, London, Gloucestershire and the Isle of Wight were removed over gaming issues. In what is believed to be the first cases of their kind, some of the youngsters were taken away because of their own addiction, while others were neglected by parents playing the games too much themselves. Hey Bill, you've got a child. We believe you're playing too many video games. We're going to take your child away. And you too, Mary. Mark Griffiths is a behavioural addiction specialist from Nottingham Trent University, and he told The Mirror, "This problem is increasing. People are now being taken into care because of their gaming, and I am not surprised." Mark Griffiths doesn't give a shit. He thinks it's a good thing. "What I'm talking about is children mainly between 8 and 18. If there is parental responsibility, children wouldn't have unfettered access around the clock. We are talking about gaming that takes over a child's life. 'Tis a neglect of all else. And if we think that's going on, well, we'll just take the child out and make the whole situation fucking worse. We'll traumatise the child by taking the child out of his or her home from the parent that they probably love, or parents. Take the children out because we think they're playing too many video games. And if it's not the children, it could be you, the mum or dad, playing too many video games. We think you're playing too many video games. We've got access to your computer remote and we think you're online too much. You're neglecting your child. So we're going to have your child." That's a massive story. It's in the Sunday Mail, the Mail on Sunday, I should say, and The Mirror over the weekend has reported on that as well. I don't need to say any more about that because I've covered this issue for years now. The state approved stealing of children for no really good reason. Not that I've ever denied that some children, unfortunately, are in homes where they're battered or sexually abused. Yes, there has to be an intervention then. Nobody would argue with it. But the vast majority of children now being taken from their homes are not being taken because they're being battered or because they are being sexually abused. They are being taken out for risk of future emotional harm. And now all these weird and wonderful little clauses that the state is looking to insert into legislation in order to better help them steal children. It's incredible. And you won't get a word out of it from your heroes on the left. Nothing from Jezza Corbyn. Nothing. I've actually witnessed people on Twitter trying to engage people like George Galloway and others. Now, I'm not having a go at George specifically. Trying to get them interested in it. Talking to them. Asking them to talk about it on their own programmes. And they don't seem to get very far. It's an untouchable issue. For the virtue signalling left. They don't want to touch it. Ah well, 25 minutes to midday. Barrister warns Azalea Banks that her racist outburst when she branded Irish people fucking ugly could see her arrested as she plays in London. Talked about this briefly on social media last week. This is a funny story. This is in the Mail on Sunday today. Barrister warns Azalea Banks that her racist outburst when she called Irish people fucking ugly could see her arrested. According to a barrister. Now, Azalea is a 27-year-old rapper. And last week, because Sunday is the beginning of a brand new week, so this is last week, she had an outburst on social media, called Irish people fucking ugly, after she stormed off an airplane which was scheduled to leave Gatwick and fly to Dublin. She basically had a row with an Aer Lingus air stewardess. So she had a row and she ended up leaving the plane and she lost her temper. She branded Irish people inbred, leprechauns, and asked if they had a famine to go dying in a series of social media comments. And that triggered a few people. Now, A guy called Thomas or Tomás McGarvey, I think it's Tomás, he doesn't have the fada on the A on his name. Tomás McGarvey, who I think is from OMA, tweeted, Hi, Azalea Banks, in light of your recent comments on Instagram about Irish women and Irish people generally, perhaps I can introduce you to the Communications Act 2003 before you land in England. If you keep up the insults, you may end up with first-hand experience of that Communications Act. He included a screenshot of Section 127 of the Communications Act 2003, which listed a series of measures which Banks' tweets and recent outbursts even could have broken. Section 127 covers offensive and threatening messages sent over a public electronic communications network. Since 2010, it is increasingly being used to arrest and prosecute individuals for messages posted to sites such as Twitter and Facebook. We're all very aware, of course, of this particular act because we followed followed the case of Alison Shablow, haven't we? Who is intimately acquainted with this very, very Orwellian bit of legislation herself after her satirical songs were deemed to have been offensive. Now, this barrister, Tomás, says that he wasn't advocating the arrest of the rapper, the woman, and fair enough. But he seems to be implying, he's certainly not denouncing the act in any way on social media. There's certainly a threat implied in tweeting somebody that particular act. He says, well, I'm a barrister, I'm just making her aware of it for her own good. And he might well be. He might well be. I can't say that that's not what he's doing. But to me, it's all very sinister. Let's forget about Tomás McGarvey for a minute. It's not his problem. It's all very sinister that people can go around claiming racism because a woman said, go and die in the famine and you're a bunch of inbred fucking leprechauns. There are people who would gladly see her arrested for that and charged with a violation of Section 127 of the Communications Act. How about we just fucking grow up? Not be offended by everything. I'm not offended by it. I couldn't give a damn. She had to leave an aeroplane over a row with a stewardess. She was livid. So she hits out and she throws a few names at people. I couldn't give a shite. To waste the time of policemen and women by asking them to investigate something as inane as some woman talking about famines and stuff like that, piss off. Drives me mad, and it's very dangerous. It's not a throwaway story. This is serious. People are being prosecuted because they've had an argument with somebody and they've called them a name. What did interest me about Azalea Banks was she did tweet something along the lines of, it's impossible for a black person to be racist, which is kind of stupid, really. Anybody and everybody has the propensity to be racist if they choose to be. Calling somebody a fucking Irish leprechaun isn't racist. I would argue that somebody who falls out with a black man on a plane might be the pilot might be black, somebody might be asked to leave the plane, he might lose his temper and call the man an effing black bastard. That's offensive to the man on the receiving end of it, but I would argue it isn't indicative of endemic racism. It's just rage manifesting itself in a personal insult. That's what I would say. And I know that my black friends and listeners listening to this will be pissed off that I said that. No, because I'm not advocating that you go around calling people black this or black that or Irish this or Irish that. I'm not advocating that. The minute you do that, you've lost the argument. Intellectually, you're gone. But don't start arresting people under the Communications Act. Don't do it. It's fucking Orwellian, right? Right. Christ almighty, did you see this story? This is all over the press today. Twitter user is investigated by police for liking a poem on social media suggesting transgender women are still men. He didn't write the poem. Not that that matters. He liked it. Right. And he retweeted it. A Twitter user is planning to complain to the Home Secretary. Don't waste your breath, mate. After police investigated him for retweeting a poem which suggested transgender women are still men. Harry Miller is furious at his Orwellian treatment by an officer who rang to check his thinking. Hi, Mr. Miller. It's PC, whatever the fuck. I'm just ringing up to find out how you're thinking. This is true. He liked a limerick, which includes the lines, "You're a man, your breasts are made of silicone, and we can tell the difference. Your hormones are synthetic." Now, doesn't sound like the best limerick ever written now, in all fairness, right? But Miller liked the limerick and got a phone call from Plaid. Honest to Christ! Right? He liked the limerick. Can't have that. Now, in total, the company director, Mr. Miller, who's a former policeman himself, ironically, had posted about 30 tweets on transgender issues when he was called by a police officer who introduced himself as representing the LGBTQ community after receiving a complaint. According to Mr. Miller of Nettleton in Lincolnshire, we need to know the details, the complainant was an unknown member of the public, who had found him via his plant management company. And the snowflake, who remains anonymous, decided that if Mr. Miller employed trans people, it was not a safe space for them. So a snowflake saw that Mr. Miller retweeted a poem about transgenderism, a limerick, and did a bit of detective work. The snowflake, the anonymous snowflake, found out that he runs a company, then decided by himself or herself that Mr. Miller might not have a safe space for transgenders in his company, then phoned the police, and the police phoned Mr. Miller. The officer, PC Mansour Gull of Humberside Police, told Mr. Miller that he had 30 tweets by him. "I've got 30 tweets by you here, Mr. Miller." When asked by Mr. Miller if any of them contained criminal material, the policeman actually read the poem over the phone, prompting Mr. Miller to say afterwards, "A cop read me a limerick over the phone. Mr. Miller said I didn't write it." And the policeman said, "Ah, but you liked it and promoted it." I then asked, Mr. Miller said, I asked the policeman, "What are you doing wasting your time on a non-crime?" And the policeman said, "It's not a crime, but it will be recorded as a hate incident." The cop told him that he needed to speak with him because, even though he committed no crime whatsoever, he needed, quote, to check Mr. Miller's thinking. "Seriously, honestly," said Mr. Miller. Finally, he lectured me. He actually gave him a lecture, saying sometimes a woman's brain grows in a man's body, and that's what transgender is. Mr. Miller told the Mail on Sunday, 1984 is supposed to be a book, not a police operation manual. To be told that the police needed to check my thinking was a bit much, you think? A bit much? Anybody else not disgusted? Anybody else want to see this through? We want to see this investigated, don't we? We want sanctions brought against the police officer and his commanding officers. Sanctions. These people have to be brought to court for harassing a private citizen because he liked the limerick on Twitter. This is harassment of a private citizen because he liked the limerick, because he thinks, well, I agree with that, actually. I agree that transgender women are not really women. I agree with that, fair enough. Like, fair enough. And he gets phoned by the police. Anybody else a bit worried about that, where that's going? And it's not an isolated incident either. Do you remember Yorkshire Police last year? Do you remember tweeting out that they wanted people to report non-crime to them? Report hate crimes. When people say things that you feel a bit uncomfortable with, tell us. Phone us up and tell us. And we'll record it as a hate crime. That was Yorkshire Police last year. Ah, mad, huh? Mad. Lunacy. In Missouri, here's a segue, here's a weird segue. In Missouri, an army vet was working out in a gym, minding his own business, on the treadmill, lifting weights, whatever, when the owner of the gym came up and asked him to leave. Well, I think she first said, "Would you take your t-shirt off?" He said, "No." "Why?" She said, "Because it's got a Trump 2016 message on it. We don't like it. Will you take it off?" And he said, "Well, no, I'm working out." So she asked him to leave the gym. This is true. I've verified this with other sources, but I've got Fox News' take on it for the laugh.
Staff Sergeant Jake Talbot says he was working out at the gym wearing his t-shirt that says 2016 Trump for president.
He's behind.
When the owner approached him, and he'll tell you the rest.
I just left CDY Fitness here in Troy working out, and when I was starting, the owner, Liz, came up to me and said that my Trump shirt that I had on was offensive and that I needed to remove it in order to work out there. And it's linked to racism.
The Army vet says he's worn the shirt several times before, and it's never been a problem. The owner of the gym responded in a now-deleted Facebook post where she said, I'm deeply saddened by the amount of hate this event has garnered. I will personally and publicly continue to defend my stance for tolerance and against hate, no matter the financial consequence. I don't believe our gym should be a political forum for anyone. I want everyone to feel safe and comfortable there.
This is a microcosm of the macrocosm. So is the story about the anonymous complainant who rang the police to say that some man liked a limerick that was lampooning transgenderism. Somebody rang up the police and said, I want to report this man liked a limerick and I'm worried that he's got a company and it's not safe for transgenders there. That's directly linked to this story. What identity politics is doing is creating what I've been calling for several years now, identitarians. My own definition, I've created my own dictionary definition of identitarian. There is a definition of it. I have a slightly different definition of it. It's introducing acute narcissism and constant moral outrage to everybody. And the establishment, the elite, the hidden hand, whatever you want to call it, loves it. It's fantastic. It is giving to people a sense of, I can get what I want and I can get my own way 24 hours a day. The world will order itself around me. And I do not have to be confronted by people or by ideas that I am opposed to. Liz in the gym looks and sees a guy working out and he's got a pretty harmless t-shirt, Trump 2016. She's outraged, says it's racist and tells the guy if he doesn't take it off, he's got to leave the gym. I know it's not the most important story you'll ever hear on Sunday View, but it's very important. Isn't it? Because this is what's happening to society. This is what momentum in the UK and absolute wet blankets like Owen Jones and others, this is the world they are ushering in. If you declare something to be hateful or that it offends you, well, we can eliminate that. We can just eliminate that because you're harmed by it, because your delicate sensitivities have been moved by it. I'm not going to labour the point here. I'm not going to go on and on because we get into this so much. It's a terrifying world, this, that they want to bring in. You know, kick a guy out of a gym because he won't take a t-shirt off. What's on the t-shirt? An image of child abuse? No. No. His preferred political candidate of choice. But I don't like that. Trump's a racist. Get out of my gym. And that's not the minority. It's becoming the majority. This is what we're doing to our children. They're thinking like this. Christ. Let's finish with Holocaust Memorial Day for the crack. Because it is Holocaust Memorial Day. And there are thousands of events taking place in the UK today, if you believe that. I don't know that I do. But anyway, apparently there are. But of course, this morning, it's all doom and gloom because apparently 5% of UK adults do not believe the Holocaust took place. And 1 in 12 believes the scale of it has been exaggerated, according to a survey. The survey was carried out by Opinion Matters. Who asked for the survey? Well, Holocaust Memorial Day Trust asked for the survey. 2,000 people were polled. Two-thirds of respondents could not say how many Jews were murdered, or they grossly underestimated the number. Oh, well, there you go. We've got some audio for you. Sky News are all over it today. Breakfast had Melina Grenfell Baines on. She's an interesting lady, Melina Grenfell Baines. She's a senior lady. She was a refugee out of Czechoslovakia. She was a very young girl at the time, so she's a very senior woman now. Melina Grenfell Baines, she was on, and she was sitting alongside Laura Marks, who chairs the Holocaust Memorial Day Trust. You'll first of all hear Stephen Dixon. Have a listen.
How do you then feel when people turn around and say,
I mean, 5% is a significant figure, saying either this hasn't happened or it is all just exaggerated. I mean, you can just dismiss that out of hand, can't you?
Well, you can't, but the interesting thing is, because I talk to a lot of schools, to a lot of children, to WIs, to Rotaries, all of them never, ever have said it didn't really happen, because I have the facts to show them that it did.
And then, Laura, how surprised were you then by these findings? 5% don't believe it ever occurred at all, or there are numbers that believe that the figures are grossly exaggerated.
That's right. I think a very easy figure to get our heads around is 64% of people who we spoke to, who were polled in this independent survey, found that or believed that the figures they didn't know what the figures were. They either grossly underestimated or they just didn't know. So the majority of people didn't know the figures. And it's funny because, you know, we grow up thinking, well, 6 million, everyone knows 6 million people were killed in the Holocaust. And the level of ignorance is quite staggering and quite frightening.
Because
it's frightening. Because you ask people a multiple choice question on the street, or you ask them a question and they don't know the answer, and that's frightening. So you say, how many people were killed in the Holocaust? And they don't say 6 million, or they say, I don't know, and you think it's frightening. What's even more frightening is you and your never-ending, relentless ramming it down our throats that there was a war in Germany. It started in the 1930s, and Jews were rounded up and put into concentration camps where they were killed and where they were tortured, along with a lot of other people from other backgrounds as well. It's relentless. Why does it matter whether they know about it or whether they don't? It doesn't matter, really.
Because we need to understand that
Stephen Dixon is very helpful here.
Understand the scale of this. I mean, it's all about not only remembering, but understanding.
But I don't want to remember. I'm sick to fucking death of the Holocaust. I really am. I don't want to hear about it anymore. I'm tired of it. I'm tired of, as I said, 6-7 times a year, films on Netflix, on Amazon Prime, films in the cinema. I'm fucking sick of it. I know that Jews were murdered in Nazi Germany. I know this. And I just don't care to be told about it 24 hours a day, or at least twice or three times a week on national television. I don't want to hear about it. And most people don't want to hear about it anyway. Because there have been far greater genocides in history. And there are genocides going on at the moment, like on the Gaza Strip, that are pressing and far more interesting and far more urgent, like what's happening in Yemen. So I'm sick to death of the Holocaust, to be honest.
Standing so that this cannot happen again.
Ah, fuck off, it's happening all the time.
That's right. And the prejudice that leads to terrible things happening is something that we still see around us today. Mm. I think that people need to remember that genocide didn't end in 1948.
Good girl. Now, this is the Holocaust Memorial Trust woman, the chair, right? This is Laura. This is not the senior lady. Good stuff. So she's going to talk about genocide since 1945. Good girl.
1945. Genocide continues today. And, you know, we had the subsequent genocides in...
Excellent.
Cambodia, Rwanda, Darfur and Bosnia.
Rwanda, Darfur, Bosnia, lovely.
Bosnia. Mm. And we continue to have a world where people...
Gaza, anyone?
A prejudice against each other. People kill each other for who they are, not for what they've done.
I wonder, has Laura seen that map of Palestine and how it's been eroded year in, year out for the last 70 years, and the Palestinians have basically been eliminated one by one? That's the biggest genocide in the world at the moment, isn't it? It's one of, anyway. Isn't it? Surely? But of course, she was never going to mention Gaza. No, we can't talk about Gaza. It's all about anti-Semitism on the rise, Jews being made to feel unsafe. But that's a load of bollocks too. And Melina Grenfell-Baines, whose family fled here nearly 80 years ago, went off message. You see, I really liked listening to the older woman whose family fled Czechoslovakia. I genuinely found her very warm and very interesting. She went off message. She went off message, and this was really scary for the Jewish propaganda woman, when the older Jewish woman said, well, I'm not sure about anti-Semitism. Stephen Dixon, the presenter, brings up Rachel Riley, the Channel 4 Countdown co-host, and apparently Rachel Riley has been subjected to all manner of anti-Semitic abuse. But wait till you hear what the older lady says.
I mean, there's quite a very well-known TV presenter. I don't know if you're familiar with Rachel Riley, who does Countdown. has been in a lot of the papers this weekend because of level of anti-Semitic abuse she's had on social media. I'm always astounded that the
virtual signalling to the moon,
these things are still going on.
I'm astounded
how people can still be holding these.
How can people hold these ideas about the Jews?
These views.
Wait till you hear the lovely old lady.
Oh, I can only say that in my personal experience, I have never experienced it.
You what? What was that? Nearly 80 years in the UK and you've never experienced it? You got to be kidding me.
I live in the north of England, and nowhere where I've been has anybody questioned my Jewishness. Has anybody ever said, you know, it hasn't happened? I can't believe that people don't believe it, but I have never personally experienced it.
That's incredible, isn't it? To be in this country for so long and to never experience, to witness, to see any evidence of anti-Semitism, it's because it doesn't exist. Wonderful lady. Fair play to her, you know. Older people, they're built to better stuff, aren't they? I imagine even if Melina Grenfell Baines had ever heard somebody saying something negative about Jews as an identity group, she probably would have told him to fuck off. I like people like that. Anyway, she went off message and the chair of the Holocaust Memorial Day Trust wasn't fucking happy and couldn't wait to clarify.
First of all, I'm delighted that Milan has never experienced personal Holocaust denial or anti-Semitism. I think that's wonderful.
She doesn't sound very delighted, does she? I'm personally delighted that Melina hasn't experienced any anti-Semitism. Yeah, what else did she say?
We know that the figures for anti-Semitism are higher than they've ever been recorded before. And we know that's in the context of all hate crime and all hate incidents being higher than before.
Bullshit, she's a liar. Back in 2017, 2 years ago, the Institute for Jewish Policy Research conducted the largest and most detailed survey of attitudes towards Jews and Israel ever conducted in Britain and found that there are no anti-Semitic attitudes inherent in English, British, Irish, Pakistani, whatever people in this country. There is no animosity towards Israel or Jews in general in the UK. The Jewish Policy Research found that it's the lowest in the world, only about 2.4% expressing some discomfort or annoyance with Jewish people or whatever. They're all fucking liars. They can stick their Holocaust Memorial Day up their arses. I'm out of here. Enjoy the rest of your Sunday. And that's not to disrespect people that were murdered in Germany or in Poland. Not at all. They're gone. They're not here anymore. All right? They're not here. They can't be offended. I couldn't give a shit. Leave them with Stevie Wonder. Enjoy the rest of your Sunday. I'll see you tomorrow at 5. Thanks for listening. Love you. Bye now. Bye.